each of the seasons of this education are 12 weeks long, punctuated by a 13th week, so that in the given year, there are four of these, like four seasons. Our natural experience of such a quartering is actually arcs on a circle, not squares, not corners, but arcs on a circle. That's our natural experience of it. But the conscious complement of it is the angle. And this particular 90 degree right angle fits the conscious sense of a quarter. So that we have two ways in which to regard the strategic pacing of events in a comprehensive way. That is to say, if we're not completely absorbed in the petty, the so-called petty order of everyday activity, if we are able to get some distance and we're able to get a sense of the whole of what's going on, or the sense of the duration of what's going on coming into a unity, if we get that kind of perspective, the natural sense is to have an arc of meaning, whereas the conscious sense is to have this angle of vision. It's as simple as that, it's as complex as that. So that a conscious angle of vision is related to an arc of meaning. Now, the whole purpose of a culture, of a traditional culture, is to preserve the fluid pace of the arc of meaning, so that all the spring rituals have to be done in the spring. You could never do a spring ritual in the fall. That's taboo. That's bad. And not just in the Ghostbuster sense of bad. We don't want to be fuzzy about the good, bad thing. Imagine every proton in the universe exploding at maximum light speed and you with it. That's bad. Okay, Ray. So the quality of traditional culture, which most of us live in, where we are emotionally secure, is to keep the proper arc of meaning happening at the right time. Whereas in consciousness, those angles of vision are actually interchangeable. In consciousness, it's very interesting to consciousness. It would be interesting to consciousness to do a spring festival in the fall. Because it doesn't have the tie to that natural quality. It recognizes the natural quality, recognizes the value, the meaning, maybe respects the tradition. But it has the option of going outside of it, and in this exact sense, consciousness is always transcendent. Transcendent to nature. Transcendent to culture. Transcendent to experience based on nature and manifest in culture. Now, the place, the locus, the focus, the medium, the thing, the quality that serves as a threshold of translating from nature to consciousness, from arc of meaning to angle of vision, is the mind. And so the mind has, as a distinctive quality, it has a bifurcation which generally since the middle of the 1600s has been mislabeled subject-object due to Monsieur Descartes. And we won't say anything more about the gentleman. Except that his major works lead to an understanding of what's known as Cartesian space based upon a conscious geometry. Descartes' geometry textbook is still in print in Dover paperback some 350 years later. One of the greatest difficulties that arises in art is to mistake the value of the angle of vision as being somehow cut off or abstracted from and no longer necessarily tied to the arc of meaning. The greatest 20th century expression of this in drama is Samuel Beckett's plays, or Giao Cometti's sculpture, or Jean-Paul Sartre's philosophy. It's a true alienation. It's a true cut-off. It does not abstract the spirit, but it reduces man to a burnt-out cinder, a match, burnt-out match stick figure. And to medieval tradition, this was the essence of evil. If you were to take yourself to Dublin and Ireland and go into Trinity College and see the great, huge manuscript of the Book of Kells, the greatest illuminated medieval manuscript in the world. They turn one page every day. If you were there on the right day, and you would see a page from the Gospel of John, outside the borders of the text is a burnt-out matchstick figure of the devil. Not the devil as a robust red figure with sexual appetites and whipping a tail with a little arrow on the end and a kind of a Ray Walton, what the devil may be, smile. Not at all cavalier. The traditional view of evil is that we are reduced, we are shrunken away from nature. We are reduced to a burnt out case condition. And traditional feeling-toned culture experiences the initial development of consciousness as just that kind of situation. And so fear comes up because of that. A neurotic suspicion of it. A phobic rejection of it, a psychotic war with it, even to those extents. But generally, it's enfolded under the taboos. So that anything that begins to have a formal, transcendent, conscious geometricity, a symbolic structure that goes inward rather than outward, traditional cultures begin to suspect that this is a disease, this is an illness that needs to be cured. And by cured, they mean brought back into the natural stew, the image base of animals and plants and soil, and complications and tribal rituals and this whole thing. And the substrate that carries all of that is the image base. So that the traditional way to handle the excesses of nascent consciousness are to deliver you to some kind of phantasmagoria where your young, fledgling, nascent, primitive consciousness is no longer able to organize the image base into a symbolic structure. And so you realize that there are terrifying limits that you've exceeded, and you very patiently, after you recover, go back and rejoin the culture, and you become tribal again. You won't explore consciousness. You might explore the phantasmagoria of the image base, but only to assure yourself that you belong exactly where you were. This is a very difficult condition when it comes to art. So I have a quotation here from Frank Lloyd Wright from his book, Genius and the Mobocracy. He wrote, "To detach oneself from the nature of the doing is the greatest calamity that can befall an apprentice." So that detachment, premature detachment, is the greatest of all calamities. Why? Because it provokes a protective response on the experiential level before you're able to counter it by conscious visioning. Before you're mature enough, in a conscious visionary sense, to do something about it, you get panicked that you're out of your league and you better get back into safety, better get back into security. And because vision is a process, it's not objective at all. It's rather like an ocean. Vision is very much like an ocean, like language is an ocean or nature is an ocean. Art is the other shore of that ocean. And so the only place where one could get one's feet again, where you could stand as an objective entity in the universe, is to go across that ocean, to navigate that ocean of vision, and come to that other shore. Now, one of the difficulties with the mind is that once you launch yourself on that ocean of vision, once consciousness begins, it has its own energy calibration, which is complementary to nature, which means that it works with it, but it only works with it in terms of unity. And if you take the context in anything less than unity, even at the purity of ivory soap, 99.44%, if you just take it even that impure, then the complementarities do not happen. Instead, they read out, they work as polarities. And you get caught in a fast highlight game of the opposites. And it's brutal. Because there's no break, and nobody's keeping score, and it's just pell-mell. So traditionally, in wisdom teachings, radically different from the kind of stuff that you find around, radically different, one only talks about this situation in retrospect. Never in prospect, never while it's happening, but only in retrospect. And that's the function of memory. That's why wisdom traditions found themselves on memory, not on imagination. Because imagination very quickly because it's image base substrate, gets itself into deep water where it cannot function. And its inability to function gives you the hallucinating phantasmagoria. It's called, in pharmaceutical terms, euphoria. And it's something to be very circumspect about. In Homer and the Odyssey, it's called the Lotus Eaters. None of the Lotus Eaters have their day of homecoming. The score is nil, zip, zero. None. Because in order to get home, one has to go into the differential energy of consciousness. And if you subside back into the natural substrate image base from the phantasmagoria, from the euphoria, you come back radioactive because you're no longer comfortably enfolded in nature, though it seems like you should be. Tradition says we can work you back in, but you never are really worked back in. And one becomes fearful of nature. Because the power of the opposites comes into play. You get caught into the polarity highlight. And what was dangerous in the nascent cosmos now gets projected back subconsciously into nature. And nature becomes very Gnostic. Whoa! The coldness of infinity, of those voids, the terror of the unknown, alien things, all of this. And suddenly, the mansion of nature is haunted. And one becomes preoccupied with ghosts and with demons, bad medicine, black magic, and the whole entourage of vision becomes a kind of a fending off by magic of the terrors that are now intuited to inhabit the natural realm. Suddenly, Bambi grows Dracula fangs. That's how the phrase holy shit got into the English language. So one of the most difficult things here in art, and it surfaces in art, and this is why the artist is tremendously courageous. The artist is tremendously courageous and creative, sort of a joyous in malapropism. This quality of courage that comes out in the artist is to see vision through to the other shore. And the other shore is always getting the work made. And so every artist worth his salt and blood and tears and whatever, every artist that really has this achievable value, this differential value, wants to get the work made. Wants to finish it. No matter what else is going to happen, this work is going to get done. And in sacrificing to the achievement of the work in turn provides the objective focus where the artists themselves are saved. And this is true of the person, because every person who becomes a person is an artist in their own life. Now, one of the best expressions of this whole complication with all of its difficult to remember angles and so forth. One of the best modern expressions of this is in Doris Lessing's novel, The Golden Notebook. She is a woman writer, and she keeps this fantastic detailed notebook of a crap life. And as she goes on in that life, she realizes, finally, she comes to grips with the fact that she's going crazy. She's going mad. Her mind is degenerating. And when she panics and she realizes that it's incontestable, she's going crazy. There's nothing anybody can do. She discovers that rereading her own notebook gives her a chance to transform that divisive energy, which consciousness is. Consciousness does not integrate, regardless of what the weekend gurus say. Consciousness does not integrate, it differentiates, which is a whole different energy. Totally different. If you think that you can pull consciousness together with a drum or whatever, have at it. Me hearties. And in The Golden Notebook, Doris Lessing has the protagonist, which is herself, really, restore her integrity, but in a new way. She becomes an artist. Whereas the Golden Notebook was a ritual recording of her experience previously, it now becomes a symbolic pattern which becomes a work of art. And at the end of the Golden Notebook, the artist has achieved, through the book that you've just been reading, her integrity as a new person. It's a fantastic work. She did it in a feminine mode, and then she got curious about how it would work out in a masculine mode, and she wrote another shorter work called A Briefing for a Descent into Hell, where a man is adrift on the ocean. Notice her beautiful symbolic metaphor. He's adrift on an ocean in an open boat, and he's dying of dehydration, and he knows if he holds on, he has his intuition, if he holds on, he can get saved. Something will happen, he'll be saved, but he has to hold on. But what's difficult is that these phantoms keep coming to haunt him in the form of doctors and nurses who are trying to convince him that he's in a coma and that they need to give him all these medications and bring him out of this. And if he can be brought out of this, they will save him. And that's a tussle between two realities, two possibilities of reality. Which one is real? Will you be saved if you give in to them and you wake up? Or will you be saved if you stay in the suffering and see it through? Because the masculine version of it has this kind of, it's like a condition that one is reminded in the 40s, there used to be these little woven grass things called Chinese puzzles, where you put two fingers in, and the more you pull on it, the tighter it would be, and you couldn't get out. And the only way to get out is to push them together and very patiently, inch, micro-inch, your way out. It's a technique which some of the more enterprising Italian composers use, called ritornello. Ritornello, little incremental returns. Vivaldi used them. And one of his greatest productions of it was the Four Seasons. And when Johann Sebastian Bach heard this technique, he realized that this was a key to developing a certain quality in his Baroque music, which would lead to a kind of a freedom. And in his violin concertos, the A minor and the E major, he used this very technique. And in the third movement of the E major violin concerto, one of the most famous and recognizable pieces of music in the world, it's been used as theme music everywhere, BVD 1042. once had to do a paper on this in San Francisco State about the history of this particular piece. I'm trying to forget that and remember enough to tell you something about it. But there is a joy that is glimpsed in the third movement of Bach's Violin Concerto that Vivaldi intuited but never saw. Bach intuited and expressed the seed of it, and then Beethoven saw that seed and took that and made the Ninth Symphony. And in order to give conscious utterance to what he had accomplished, Beethoven looked around to try to find somebody who had said it in a conscious way. And he didn't find it in Goethe or any of the others. He found it in Schiller. Schiller's Hymn to Freedom, or Ode to Joy, as they mistranslate it sometimes. Because Schiller was one of the really great conscious artists on a level of Plato. Schiller is so underestimated, it's just impossible. Now we're going to use one of Schiller's books called On the Aesthetic Education of Man. And pairing up with this, we're going to use Igor Stravinsky's Poetics of Music. And again, the pairing of books is meant not to have some kind of text which we study. That's not it at all. We're working with unities. We're working with 100%. So that complementarities are in play at all times, so that at any given moment, in any given week, in any given season, in either of the 2 years, that can happen. You can get an insight, you can get a divine spark, a quality of eureka, the aha. And the feeling tone that accompanies that aha is a certainty, a living certainty that you're somehow at the right place at the right time now. And unlike Cartesian geometry, which needs 2 points to make a line, that kind of insight is a Euclidean geometry. Goes back to old Pythagorean times. You only need 1 point in order to establish a locus, because the resonance of even 1 point already creates a condition, and any movement whatsoever creates a vector. This is the way in which consciousness establishes itself painstakingly, bit by bit. Now, Schiller, in On the Aesthetic Education of Man, it's about art. How does art happen? How do we get to a place where we can appreciate art? What's involved here? What's the conscious, mature version of this? It's a series of letters, and in this series of letters to a friend, Schiller manages, in a 27-letter cycle, almost a lunar cycle, 28-day. Remember, Yeats is a vision. The 28-day cycle is universal. Here's a 27-letter cycle, which means that the final letter must be written to you by you. In this, the 11th letter begins with one of the most powerful ideas in world history. He writes in translation, "When abstraction rises to the highest level it can possibly attain, it arrives at two ultimate concepts. It doesn't say here, but he means simultaneously. Why? Because an ultimate is not some point up here on a vertical scale. An ultimate is the consonance sphere of the exact center. If you're in an integration mode, that ultimate will be the center. And its ultimate is called realization. And in an integration mode, the actual apex, the ultimate, is not some point at the center. The point at the center is a penultimate. It's one step removed from the ultimate. That someone talks about, they want to center themselves. That's fine. Center yourself. The ancient technique of centering yourself was from pottery, from ceramics. On the circling wheel, you got your clay there and you lump it up. The wheel's going around. How do you get to the center? If you don't start in the exact center, the pot's not going to be thrown right. It's going to not only be wobbly, but it's not going to fire up right. How do you get to the center? You can take any finger, usually I took the ring finger, and just trace a vector in towards the clay, and you can see. Because it will spiral as it goes around, and the center will be made. So literally, if you like to take the Renaissance version, you can put your finger and let the divine touch your finger through making the center apparent. You put your pair of thumbs in there, you can throw that pot. If you can feel it, if you can feel, just feel the symmetry. And you do it with two hands, not with one hand. Notice? So at ultimates, there's always this kind of pairing, but the pair becomes symmetrical and they have a complementarity between them. And then wholeness works and whatever form is made will hold. Stravinsky, not Stravinsky, but Schiller. We're going to come to Stravinsky in just a moment. See how my mind just naturally is going to Paris? Okay. Schiller and Stravinsky, they're there together. Schiller, when abstraction rises to the highest level it can possibly attain, not in an integration mode, which would be the center, but in a differential mode, which is the symmetry. Symmetry. In the differential mode of consciousness, the apex is symmetry. In the very first chapter of the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu says, the Tao cannot be named, but that which can be named is the mother of all things. And that mother turns out to be Te. It turns out to be the power of Te, of holding things together. In differential consciousness, the Te is always the symmetry. Always. If you go into nuclear physics, every particle has a spin value, even if the spin is zero. And the spins are 1, or 1/2, or 0. Why? Because they are all variations on wholeness, on unity. They have to be, because the universe could not be real unless that condition obtained. Now the spin can be 1/2, can be left, it can be right. It doesn't make any difference. They're slightly more right-handed particles in the universe than there are left-handed, and that's made up complementary in the magnetoelectric realm, where left-handedness is slightly favored. You get more lefty pitchers in the magneto-electric universe, but you get right-handers in the electromagnetic universe, where we spend most of our time. When abstraction rises to the highest level it can possibly attain, it arrives at two ultimate concepts, before which it must halt and recognize that here it has reached its limits. Not its limits as in some kind of resistance barrier beyond which you need to be a James Dean to get through. It's not that at all. It's that these limits are symmetrical on a sphere that if you expand the sphere at all, they both expand. Not codependent, but complementarities. What are these two? What is the symmetry that Schiller's talking about 200 years ago? Very conscious character. He writes that its effect in us is that it distinguishes something. It distinguishes in man something that endures and something that constantly changes. Something that is eternally there and something that eternally is changing. Being and becoming, whatever you like. That which is endured evokes something which we call person. And that which changes evokes what we call condition. So let's hear it again and just appreciate, even though it's 200 years old, that's not too bad. When abstraction rises to the highest level it can possibly attain, it arrives at two ultimate concepts before which it must halt and recognize that here it has reached its limits. It distinguishes in man something that endures and something that constantly changes. That which endures calls forth his person. That which changes calls forth his condition. Person and condition. The self and its determining attributes. Are in the finite being eternally too. So that there is a peculiarity in consciousness where person and condition maintain, even at 100% realization, they maintain a complementation. They do not merge. Why do they not merge? Because they had already merged in realization. So that the further that one goes in consciousness, the more that the complementarity has space to play, so that person and condition both expand together. So the question, the very first question that one would ask, well, what happens then? Where does this go? What happens? It means that a cosmos occurs, which at the same time that it is cosmic, is someone. Now you can write out in any language, in any style of calligraphy, God, and then you can label that. In no way is it a thing. In no way is it reductively just someone, or even someone with a capital S, or all caps, or italics. It doesn't make any difference. What obtains is a fullness, the capacity for which is that it sustains within its actuality, person and condition is symmetrical. A simple way to say this is that at this stage, I in my life have an equivalence and an intimate equivalence, an equanimity, but that we are not reducible to identity. And that in no way is this an impairment. Now, the Cartesian quality of geometry is that the proof of truth is being able to be reduced to identity. It's very comfortable French pre-Enlightenment tribal doctrine. Only by being able to reduce something down to its identity can you then say that it objectively occurs. Well, that's true only in an integration mode on a tradition level where one is working with a ritual based mentality. Only there is A equals A a proof of truth. Nowhere in the visionary world is A equals A sufficient. So that in a really powerful logic like Leibniz, who took Descartes and many of the other followers of that view to task. The book was never published in his lifetime. This was dangerous stuff. In consciousness, A equals A is neither necessary nor sufficient. Simply A will do. Simply A. Now, Henry Moore, bring in Henry Moore now. Moore tried to work with sculpture in such a way that his art was conscious in such a way that its conscious fullness would open out to the cosmos and the person. And in doing so, he balanced not only the form of the sculpture, but the space of the sculpture. In this little book about Henry Moore by his friend John Russell, I excerpted this quotation to go along with the Frank Lloyd Wright quotation. The Wright quotation was, "To detach oneself from the nature of the doing is the greatest calamity that can befall an apprentice." The Moore quotation, not of Moore, but of John Russell about Moore, writing about his great reclining figure sculpture of 1951, which I believe that we had a slide of, he writes, "Moore here commands the air. For the first time in his career, he had produced a piece of which no one drawing could give anything like the total effect. For there was no longer any principal view or best view from which that total effect could be summarized." Now, in an integration mode, there's always a principal view. There's always a best view. The identity is established in terms of the context of the principal view, the best view. Whereas in the differential mode, there is no best view. There is no principal view. There is no identity framework through which one can establish the truth of it. One has to broaden experience to a whole sphericality and experience the actuality itself differentially in order for the aren't to come forth. This is the same for a conscious person. There's no way on the tribal level that anyone could appreciate a conscious person. They're always unseen, misseen, mistaken. Even somebody as recondite and circumspective as Confucius, Kung Fu Tzu. He came out from visiting Lao Tzu and he said, man can understand almost everything, but there's nothing he can do about a dragon. I asked my Chinese mentor once, Gai Yushu, what dragon really was in ancient Chinese, the character, what did it really mean? And he said, rain and mist without end. Who knows? For those of you who are new, my favorite saying is that in the future, when our descendants understand machines, they will unplug them. Let's take a break. I had to start off with a word, and we had to look it up. And the Oxford English Dictionary, unabridged, didn't have it. And the Oxford Companion to Music didn't have it. And my old set of Groves Encyclopedia of Music, I found that volume M was missing all these years. We finally found it in the Encyclopedia of Music, and the term is a Greek word, melos, melos, from which we get melody. But the definition here is the ascending and descending movement of tones. Mi, fa, so, la. The ascending and descending movement of tones, our modern conception of melody, with the exclusion of rhythmic elements. Scales, musical scales, were arranged in certain patterns by the Greeks, called the Dorian, the Phrygian, the Lydian, my favorite, the Mixolydian. Mixolydian timbre is very sweet to me. Weird, that's all. And all of these, you can use the term melos, like the Dorian melos or the Lydian melos. And the reason why we're trying to look it up is that I have a quotation from Igor Stravinsky, who was educated and noble and grand, the way people used to be in the old days. And so he used the term melos here. And we were a little unsure about it. And this is the quotation. This is from the Poetics of Music, six lectures that Stravinsky gave at Harvard one time. The language of music is strictly limited by its notation. Whatever the musical notation is, that's the form. And then distinct from that, the dramatic actor thus finds he has much more latitude in regard to chronos, that is time, and intonation. So a dramatic actor can vary his timing and his intonation. It's very effective and very important. One of the characteristics that made John Wayne a big star in his time was that his timing was always punctuated by these fighters' gestures. So that you're trying to follow the language and you got the oomph quality of his delivery. as distinct, say, from like the finesse of Henry Fonda, who always was using some kind of gentle, fluid gesture to punctuate. So his language always came out smooth. So you always think of John Wayne as the Duke, and you always think of Henry Fonda as Mr. Fonda. So that the timing and intonation of the dramatic actor has a lot of latitude, and you can develop a style along that. Stravinsky is saying that, distinct from the dramatic actor who has this latitude, the singer of a musical composition is tightly bound to tempo and melos. You have to be able to sing in the scale and keep the timing of the piece, so that the language of music is strictly limited by its notation. So that musical notation actually has a ritual comportment, which is very definite. So one then asks, well, where does the art of music come in? Obviously, music is one of the great arts. And we're pairing Stravinsky with Schiller, so that next week we'll see that the art of the person is related very intimately to, like, the art of music. And incidentally, the art of mathematics. The art of mathematics and the art of music are both tied to a ritual notation, which needs to be exacting, and the delivery of which needs to be exacting, and yet there's art there. And the person is very much like this. It's almost a paradox. That is to say, to, quote, normal sensibility, to standard experience, to cultural tradition, mathematics, music, persons are paradoxical. Their true actuality, their true nature, is very peculiar. So that the person is really experienced by a traditional cultural ethos as an alien. A lot of the projections about aliens are projections upon the mysteriousness of the person. And for all intents and purposes, a person who has enlarged to a cosmic scale might as well be from another star system, because they would be at home in any star system. It doesn't make any difference whatsoever. To put it on a pedestrian scale, just to talk about, traditional astrology uses 12 constellations, and wherever your sun happens to be, that will be the constellation characterizing your horoscope. You're a Sagittarius, you're a Pisces, when in actuality, if one takes the entire sphere, the entire celestial sphere, there are 88 constellations. So that a cosmic person, instead of having one constellation that would characterize them, would be at home in all 88, which is the number of keys on a piano. Isn't that interesting? So it's the difference between somebody who sounds one key and says, well, that's me. Somebody who can play the whole piano. Now, there's not much more you can get out of one key. You can get rhythm. You can get variations in rhythm. But the melos is always just only that. Whereas a cosmic person has the entire piano and can play any piece you can compose, or score that has ever been composed. So the difference is literally astronomical. And there's no way that a universal person fits into a tribe, even though they could, because they're usually consummate actors, they could join a tribe very easily. But they can just as easily leave the village. Now, this is a difficult problem because most education is tribally based, is tradition founded. And most education has to not only kowtow and toe lines and so forth, but has to work within those confines. And it does. And it normally always has. So that the variations that one has in this kind of education, eventually, from a cosmic view, amounts to shop talk. And it's not very interesting from that perspective. So that traditional educations, wisdom educations, always had a hiatus of silence that was like a threshold buffer through which you would pass. And before you could speak, you had to learn to be silent. The archetype for this, the prototype, was the Pythagorean wisdom communities in southern Italy about 2,500 years ago. And you were enjoined upon coming into the Pythagorean community, which was the education, the learning about the cosmos together, that population. The first 5 years were spent as, the Greek word for that was akousmatiki, those who were able to listen. You were able to listen, but not to speak. And only after a five-year threshold buffer zone, when your ear had become acclimated to a differential magical language, were you then able to speak, because what you experienced as a prohibition initially, you cannot speak. That kind of prohibition actually was a necessary step in the acquiring of the new language. That the new language was not at all what was being used on an everyday level. On an everyday level, words were representative stand-ins for things. So that you could literally write a word and find some object to paste it on. This word tree, this thing here, this word book, write it out, paste it, this is a book. I once, when I was an undergraduate, was a chef in an Italian restaurant in Madison, Wisconsin, run by the Chicago family. And I don't mean Archie Bunker. And the owner, in typical family style, when he wanted to get the message across, was a little abrupt. And he got peeved one time that the place was not swept up enough. So he wrote out on these sticker pads, clean this, and then he pasted that on every damn thing you could see. Clean this, clean this, clean this. That's the kind of language that works on a level of tradition and culture and tribal headmen, right? You clean this. There's no metaphor. And you don't want to say what. I think the sound effect is ch-ch, as in. Whereas in magic language, there's ambidextrousness and ambiguity and paradox everywhere. Every word is charged with all kinds of possibilities, and they can be run together. Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce's case in point, total magical language. In writing to Ezra Pound, James Joyce said that while he had great success with Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man as a classical novel, and then put it into stream of consciousness with Ulysses, he was going to do to Ulysses what the old monks had done to the gospel in the Book of Kells. He was going to illuminate every page so that the traditional language didn't matter at all. It was just a source of design idea for a new scale of creation. Because looking at an illuminated manuscript, the whole purpose is not to read the language, but to go into this differential trance of being able to expand one's visionary realm to the cosmos. And there are some pages of the Book of Kells that are taken up entirely by one letter. You don't even need to just reduce it to one word, just one letter. Because if you have that visionary capacity, that differential consciousness, a single Cairo tells you everything about Jesus you ever need to know. This is the same thing in Buddhist mysticism. Before there were all the Asian Buddhisms, there was a Greek Buddhism. The very first international Buddhism was Greek Buddhism. Out of that came the Bodhisattva. And the wisdom literature of the Bodhisattva was called perfection literature, literature that opened up to perfection. Prajna Paramita Sutras. And the very first Prajna Paramita Sutra was huge. It was 100,000 slokas, which are couplets. So it was 200,000 lines. It's enormous. And within one generation, they'd come down to a Prajna Paramita Sutra that was one syllable. Ah. Because when differential consciousness gains its person, the person is like a prism. And once the person is objectively real, they have this eternal capacity to take one photon of light and project out and differentiate the entire spectrum. Now, it's true, in ancient times, a couple thousand years ago, it took a yogi to do that. But men and women have worked like hell for the last couple of millenniums, and there's a 20-lane highway that leads to being able to do that. There must be hundreds of varieties and versions of scores of paths that actually do that and lead that way. And one has to be very democratic about it, because what are they? The traditional saying is, any path to the top of the mountain gets you there. So that the person, as a differential object, is not a thing. To think of a person as an identity is totally reductive nonsense. Person is like a prism, perfect prism, in total suspension, is wherever it is, and is able to differentiate out further the whole spectrum of possibility onto scale of cosmos. All 88 constellations And those are just 88 constellations from this particular planet orbiting this particular star. If you look up and you see the constellation of Orion, which is the most primordial of all constellations on this planet, Orion was the initial constellation that was made, and its rising signaled the spring of flooding quality of the Nile. If you look at Orion and you see the three stars in the belt of Orion, and then you see the bright giant stars up above and the very large stars down below, and you see that group of seven stars, and you see a constellation Orion, and anybody on the planet can recognize it. But if you were taken to the top right star, which is named on this planet Bellatrix, they call it something else. I can't pronounce it. If you were taken to Bellatrix, which is about 450 light years away, you would still be 400 light years away from a number of those other stars, including the three stars in the belt and the two largest stars. And you would see from one of the stars in the constellation of Orion still a constellation that had three stars in a row, and Betelgeuse and Rigel there. And you would see this fantastic shape. It would look like cosmic Zorro sign. So on Bellatrix, the same area of the heavens stands for the rising of the spring season in ancient antiquity, but it's five stars and not our constellation. And from there, all the other 88 constellations are likewise completely refigured, and who knows, it doesn't have to be 88. A celestial sphere can have any number of constellations. You could be positioned about 10 million light years outside the Milky Way galaxy, and you would see galactic structures that look so thick that they look like stars. You wouldn't see any stars at all, because at 10 million light years, you're outside of even the satellite galaxies that the Milky Way has. But you would not see a blank sky with just a few dots. You would see millions of galaxies. To paraphrase Isaac Asimov, the galaxy's like dust. Harvard University Observatory took to charting the location of galaxies and made this beautiful chart. And when they got to 6 million, they stopped, because they realized that as telescopes got better and better resolution, there were like not just 6 million, but who knows, hundreds of millions of galaxies. And so the question to the astrologers is, how many constellations would you like to work with? And the little asterisk relates to a footnote that you would put, that you wouldn't show them right away because you don't want to show them up too badly. You would say, a universal person is capable of having all of those constellations and all of those galactic structures totally at once as characteristic of their true scope. So what in the hell is this checking the horoscope in the newspapers to find out what you're capable of? I know the Hollywood phrase, but I'll defer from saying it. A wisdom education carries one out of the pedestrian into enough togetherness and maturity where you're taken to the threshold where you can see that you can grow as far as you want to grow, as long as you want to grow, and you don't have to consult anybody else. You can do this. This is the point of freedom. That's the point of freedom. Freedom is not freedom of choice. Freedom doesn't have to do with choice. It has to do with aletheia, with truth. I think the phrase translated out of St. John is the truth will make you free. Not that the truth will deliver best view of possible choices. That's not it at all. That's completely pedestrian. So that the scale of criticism that could be brought against the standardized tribal educational norm that obtains on this planet now is tidal wave colossal. And there's no sense in going into it because it's not only all wrong, every variation of it is also wrong. And so one has to hearken to some wisdom. Carl Jung once remarked, he said that in a therapeutic situation, it's better to teach someone one thing new than to get them to go back and repair several thousand things that were wrong way back when. Because one of the qualities that's there in our species, we're called wisdom primate, Homo sapien, sapiens, doubled, wisdom. And it's not just wisdom is like wisely wise. We can be self-reflectively wise, not just wise, but wise about being wise. We can learn. We can teach ourselves anything whatsoever. And with that Promethean tool, we can navigate even the most chaotic phantasmagoria computerly possible and find some way to vector out. I can't remember what episode it was, but in Star Trek, they got into a confusion one time of time and space, and Captain Kirk heroically turned to Spock and said, well, how do we get out of this? And Spock laconically said, just reverse our path. Why not? So that the saving vector sometimes is surprisingly easy. It just takes doing. And in order to get the traction to just turn and go the other way, you have to have some place where you can get some traction on at least one foot. So that if even the most elegant yogi has to pivot at least on one toe. And if you're in a situation where you cannot find any objectivity in the universe, and there are conditions like that, two people together can make an objectivity between them out of nothing. In astrophysics, it's called a barycenter. And two completely crazy people in a completely crazy universe that do a pas de deux together create a traction place where they could both pivot and leave, exit. This is magic. This is big magic. This is not like levitating some book off the table. This is big magic. This is levitating the prismatic seed of a true cosmos out of complete madness. That's what magic language is all about. Now we have in this education, at the very beginning of art, we looked at two figures together. We looked at Kandinsky and John Dewey. Kandinsky's Concerning the Spiritual in Art and Dewey's Art as Experience. Then we moved on to Moore and Wright. And next week we're going to move on to Schiller and Stravinsky. But let's just momentarily go back, recursively go back and catch up with Kandinsky. Let's go back to Kandinsky. We began Art 1 2 months ago exactly with a poem. And Kandinsky's poem is called Seeing. Seeing. I think seeing here is not so much a noun as it is a gerund, a verbal structure. Sehen, sehen, seeing. And this is the poem. Blue. Blue arose and fell. Sharp, thin, whistled and penetrated, but did not pierce through. Everywhere a rumbling. Thick brown hovered, seemingly for all eternity. Seemingly, seemingly. Spread your arms wider, wider, wider. Cover your face with a red cloth. And perhaps it is not yet displaced at all. Only you have displaced yourself. White chink after white chink, and in this white chink, a white chink, in every white chink, a white chink. It is not good that you fail to see the turbid. It is precisely in the turbid that it dwells. And that is where everything begins. There was a crash. Do you like my chorus? One's reminded of Jean-Paul Sartre's play, The Flies. The guilt is trapped, right? At last! Let it suffer a while. Tormented us plenty of times, right? Buzz away, sucker. What is Kandinsky's poem about? Kandinsky's poem is about how, if you use a language which refers to things, it's still on somebody else's little sticker pad. As long as you use that language, it's always going to stick to objects, and you're always going to have to clean it up. You don't have to use that language. But in order to use a different language, you're going to have to master silence. Once you've mastered silence, once you experience nature without language, even though you have language as a capacity, you gain a, it's called in Protestant theology, and I use it because it's one of the most accurate English terms there is, it's called in Protestant theology, witnessing. You witness nature happening, but you don't label it. And because you don't label it, it doesn't put you into the judgmental, vengeant activity. You don't have to judge it. You don't have to get even. Who cares that they cut you off? You just are witnessing them cutting you off. You don't slam on the brakes over much, just enough to make sure you don't crunch them. Let it go. Let it pass. But that period of silence is a hiatus. It's not a goal. It's not a place to stay. It's a threshold. It's a frame through which one passes. And you can pass straight forward if you want. You can back in through it. You can go into it crab-like sideways. It doesn't make any difference at all. You can tumble through it. You could skip through it as long as you're silent. Silent meaning as long as you disengage the language, because the language is the way in which the ritual comportment further integrates itself. Now, in witnessing, you can just do. It takes a very high yogi to sit quietly and do nothing and have something happen. Wu Wei is not parlor stuff. But anyone can continue to do without speaking about it, without letting the mental voice speak, without shooting your mouth off, without getting into critical, sarcastic, sardonic, clever, commentarial about it. Just simply, okay, it's happening, but you're there with it, witnessing it happening. Frank Lloyd Wright's quotation from earlier this morning, to detach oneself from the nature of the doing is the greatest calamity that can befall an apprentice. The ritual comportment, what we do, needs to keep going on, but we can disengage language temporarily. And when we do, the symbolic capacity goes directly to not the ritual. The mind is objective, the ritual is objective. In ritual comportment, the body is the focus. In symbolic comportment, the mind is the focus. But because they're both objective, because they, in cinematographic terms, they montage perfectly. So that the mind anneals itself, it's an alchemical term, anneals itself perfectly with the body, so that the mind is there and it is objective vis-a-vis nature. So that all there is mind and nature. There's no pair of ritual and myth that get in as an interface, as an intervening, so that when mind and nature are simply there together, realization is very easy. Very easy. Because there are none of these little tiny thorny hedges of representation and tradition and cultures, no matter how valuable they are in their own right, they're just simply not in play. And not being there, the mind very quickly gains its objectivity, not secondhand from the language, not in a third-rate way vis-a-vis existence, but direct. Sudden, direct. And the mind in that way very quickly operates in a transformational way so that vision comes, one might always almost say, although it's a paradoxical use, that vision comes naturally. The supernatural comes very easily. The transcendence happens very, very, very easily. One is not getting rid of, one is not erasing, one's not taking out of the program, deleting the whole area where culture is, the whole area where tradition is. Nobody wants to do that. And if you can work with it, fine. This education works with it. This education just simply factors it into the integral so that if one just did it, and kept up with it, it would work. But granted, it's a lot of work. If you really do this course, it's a lot of work. You should get 100 credits, university credits per semester or per quarter. It's a lot of work because it opens up very quickly. And not simple at all. I remember showing it to one leading educationalist and thought it was a great books program. I didn't snicker. I'm old enough to be a gentleman when I need to be. I can be bad, but I can also defer it. That transformation, when vision comes into play, the mind is ambidextrous vis-a-vis nature or vision. The mind's at home in consciousness as much as it is in nature. And the mind can do that pirouette without making a move. The mind makes that pirouette, and the Greek term for that in Plato is metanoia. He got it from Pythagoras. Plato visited a Pythagorean community in southern Italy when he was about 40 years of age. He had heard about them. He had studied with Socrates, who knew about them. And he had met some Pythagoreans, but when he went himself and experienced it, he got it. And all the Platonic dialogues after that have factored into them the transformation of metanoia. He understood aletheia before. He understood truth, getting to truth. That the dialectic, the dialogue, can arrive at the undivided truth. But he didn't realize until he had visited a Pythagorean community that when, instead of carrying integration to its ultimate, instead of carrying integration to realization, one can put a transformation there. Instead of realization, one can have a transformation. And the mind not only carries to realization, but it carries through it. Carries through it. And when it comes out, it comes out on the far side where there's another shore. And that other shore turns out to be very huge. Turns out to be huge on scale of, well, I think the current cosmological theory is that there are huge bubbles in intergalactic space-time, some of them 400 million light years across, and galaxies sort of collect in the surface tension of these huge bubbles in time-space. And that in this cosmic foam, one gets the first indications of what the other shore is like. And not just in Plato, not just that metanoia, not just the turning around of the mind, where the mind turns around from a language that's referent-based to a language that is magical and able to play with an ambidextrous paradoxicality, it becomes poetic. And instead of identity, A equals A, being some criteria for truth, the criteria becomes open-ended. Instead of some Cartesian-influenced categorical imperative, a la Immanuel Kant, where before you do something, you have to ask yourself the question, what if everybody did this? Well, if everybody did this, well, I better not do this. One turns it completely inside out, and one asks the existential imperative, what if nobody did this? And almost invariably, except for mass murder, things like that, the conclusion is, well, if nobody did this, the universe would be minus this value. I think I'll add this value to the universe. So the existential imperative opens out possibility indefinitely. Whereas using identity as some kind of a basis turns out to be a constriction on ethic, which finally adds more glue than there are objects to be glued. And you get a world where, I was just reviewing Jean-Luc Godard's Alphaville, Humphrey Bogart meets IBM, where the detective, Lemmy Caution, goes into this huge universal galactic city, Alphaville, and finds the only woman who still understands that she knows what words mean beyond what the computer has allowed her to know, and she discovers that she knows what love is. And of course, she's immediately persona non grata in Alphaville because this is forbidden. You're a danger if you know what a word means, really, and not what you've been told it should mean. Then you've got to leave town. Fortunately, she has Lemmy Caution, who knows how to leave town. He simply shoots the opposition, grabs a car, and drives out of the labyrinth. And the computer lets him go, of course, because he's too dangerous. She could be killed, but to let him stay in town is more dangerous than to let him leave. Then it's really valuable to be dangerous. As Donald Sutherland tells Jane Fonda, Steel Yard Blues, a phrase that he learned in prison. He said, you're tough, but you aren't dangerous yet. They leave you alone when you're dangerous. One way to differentially get free. When we come to next week, to Art 9, be aware that each season, remember how we began today? That there's a quaternary, there are four seasonal quarters, and that each quarter has a transition point where this particular 12-week segment is finished and another 12-week segment has not begun. Interseasonal. They're called in annual year rituals the equinoxes and the solstices. And you can mark the equinoxes and the solstices with ceremonies that pertain to the entire year because they're interseasonal. The vernal equinox belongs as much to summer as it does to spring. The autumnal equinox belongs as much to winter as it does to summer. The summer solstice belongs equally to summer and autumn. The winter equinox, or solstice, belongs to winter and to spring. Either way. So after 12 weeks of any given quarter of this education, we have a holiday Saturday. They don't need to hear it. We're working with consciousness now. In the first year, we didn't pay much attention to the fact that we're going to have an interval week. We just simply did it. Now I would like to encourage you that we're looking ahead because consciousness is foresight. It's foreseeing. Why is it foreseeing? Because your witnessing now has creative capacity. How you witness is going to influence the way in which the gestalt is being formed. You're now a factor in the way in which time-space happens. Everyone who has this visionary differential energy now begins to participate creatively in how life is going to work, how things are going to turn out. Nobody on the tribal level can do that. Nobody in tradition can do that. Nobody in the integration mode can do that. Literally, it's a stacked deck. You have to work with the natural matrix. There's no other way. That's how the notation reads. But once you have lifted the notation off the page and into the instruments, a conductor can do it his way. You can conduct your life your way. You can make it your style. But it doesn't work very well until you begin to develop foresight and you learn that this is the way, because in a differential mode, it opens up. The furthering of it is not coming together, but opening up. So with art 9, we're 2/3 of the way through the art quarter. We want to look ahead, and we realize that the next quarter is history, and that history is very, very precarious. History is more precarious than magic. History is a real bad case acid. It's an aquaregia. It dissolves anything that cannot hold its own. History will dissolve you. If you didn't really become a person, history eats you up. Mircea Eliade, in The Myth of the Eternal Return, the last section is called The Terror of History. And the 20th century literally has been gobbled up by the Godzilla of history. History where not many people are putting their creative person into play, and so the medium, because it's a transformational medium, can work negatively as well as positively. It has that ambidextrousness. And so it dissolves instead of transforms. To paraphrase Fidel Castro, history will dissolve you. He said absolve, but dissolve. And at the end of the 20th century, we find a civilization that is so tattered and moth-eaten by having been dissolved by history that its fragility is brittle and can never be saved. If something new is not made, the old will simply tarnish and weather away. It's never going to be viable again. Never. The most powerful phrase 2,000 years ago about that condition was a phrase in one of the esoteric Jewish writings about Jesus. Not a Christian writing. The Christians outlawed it and burned all the copies. He says, the power of the stars has had a third of its energy taken away. They'll never be whole again. That cosmos will never be whole again. It will just simply run down, and those who still live by it will run down with it. It's not just that a world has ended, but it's that a whole reality has transformed, and only the new has any possibility of differentially growing. The old collapses upon itself and ends up in a permanently regressive radioactive heap. It's this kind of quality, which is so beautifully symbolized, Howard Hawks in his movie The Thing, The Carrot from Another Planet. And at the end, it's dissolved in this arc of electricity down to a little smoldering heap that keeps shrinking. The old reductive self keeps reducing and becomes just a smoldering radioactive nothing until it vanishes. It's this kind of quality that's there now. This particular world that obtains is running down. There's no way to save it. No one can prop it up. There's no way to give it any kind of differential value. But it doesn't have to end. It can transform. It doesn't have to be a tragedy, it can be a mystery. The universe is full, much more full of mystery than it is of tragedy. You have to control and limit greatly to make a tragedy happen. You can do that if you want to. And it's about 50-50 between comedy and tragedy. You can try comedy if you want. But it's overwhelmingly easier to try mystery, because mystery, like a neutral, like a zero spin, comedy and tragedy have their little spins and they skew off constantly, and you have to compensate for it. You have to be a really good mathematiki. You can do it if you want. If you want to surf destiny, have at it. You can hang 10 to the 10th. But mystery is so common in the universe's reality that literally we're invited to transform and to go that way. So that the new is much easier than the old ever was. You don't have to patch the new. Nourish it. It's easy to understand it when it's put into a metaphor. Once a baby is born, you don't want to stick the head back into the womb. It's as simple as that. Because the whole reason for a baby is for a life to develop and unfold. So the whole purpose of reality is for the mystery that we are in to differentially open up. That's when Mother Nature, to use a sexist metaphor, that's when Mother Nature becomes a girlfriend. A lot more possibilities. Well, I can see by the psychological state that we should quit there. Let's quit.